Hey, good morning, everybody. Good morning, good morning, good morning. Okay, I got my microphone this time. Appears to be working. PA system's working. That's very nice. I'm going to turn some lights down. But I need to turn that one on up over there. Okay. Okay. Well, today's a pretty important day because we got to finish up a chapter before the exam on Thursday, right? So your exam is about half a week away, and the projector on the right-hand side is working just fine. So let's take a look at the schedule. So what the heck is today? It is April 21st. Indeed it is. Okay, April 21st, Tuesday. And we're going to finish up blood, heart, and circulation. That's chapter 13. And then next time is exam number 3, covering chapters 10, 11, 12, and of course 13. And then after that, we just got a few more chapters left in the class. So next time, you need a picture ID. You need a good eraser and a pencil and a Scantron that's nice and clean, not folded, mutilated, and all marked up, right? Just a nice Scantron, because you'll probably want to see your grades right away. And if somebody doesn't put their answer sheet in the correct pile or has marks all over it and I can't grade it, then I probably won't get your grade into Blackboard. And that's important because the 26th, that is this Sunday, is the last day to drop with a W. After that period of time, I got to give you a grade, a letter grade. Can't give you a W anymore. Probably nobody in here is going to drop, but just in case you're considering that, drop on Saturday. Don't wait until Sunday in case there's a problem with a computer somewhere. There was a problem with Blackboard. I sent everybody some emails saying I reactivated or activated some quizzes. I never got a copy of it, so I presume you never got a copy of those emails. So computer problems do arise. So get things done sooner rather than later. You did get them?
Yeah.
Oh, good. Okay.
The quiz for this week was there. The quiz for next week is
there.
Not there.
Okay.
You know how you have like the study guide and practice stuff before the quiz?
Yeah, yeah.
All that's there is just at the bottom. There's no quiz.
Okay. I'll check. I'll have to check on that. I thought I activated that. Right. I don't know if it's just your section or all the sections. Yeah, because I want you to get a jump on that one. But don't get it confused, right? Stuff it due next week is not on this test, right? So you got to pay attention to that. All right, so this is Bio 241. It's April 21st, and we're going to finish up. Here's some slides. The slideshow is not working, so I'm just going to show you this in the not in the slideshow mode, but just in the working mode. We'll have to just work at it as is. Okay, so does anybody have any questions over what we've covered? Blood, heart, and circulation. If you think of blood, how many major compartments does it have?
Four.
Okay, the heart has four major compartments, but I'm just thinking of blood. I like formed elements and plasma. So just two, formed elements and plasma. You can group everything in blood into those two components, right? And so what are some formed elements?
Red blood cells.
Platelets. All the white blood cells. Wow, I can't even switch slides right here, okay? All right, yeah, white blood cells, those are formed elements, platelets, red blood cells, white blood cells, and then the plasma contains all the other stuff that can dissolve into a water environment. Some proteins like clotting factors, some proteins like globulins that can fight infection or act as detergents so that other fat-soluble molecules can dissolve in water. All right, and albumin, which keeps us from, what does albumin do in our blood? It keeps us from swelling up, right? And the liver is important for producing all that albumin, right? So blood is very concentrated with solute because of all that albumin. So water moves down its concentration gradient from extracellular space back into the blood, via a capillary. And without that albumin, then water is going to leak out of your blood vascular system into tissue spaces. Okay, so what's the best way to think of an agglutination or transfusion reaction? I heard antibody, then I heard antigen, and then I heard antigen-antibody reaction. That's perfect, right? So you should have a picture in your mind what an antigen looks like, what an antibody looks like, where you find them. And as a matter of fact, just go ahead and tell me, where do you find antigens?
On the surface
of the red blood cells. That's right. So a type A person would have a antigen on their surface, right? And at the same time, that person is going to produce an antibody. What antibody is that person going to produce automatically?
Anti-B.
Anti-B, yeah. So you got to be familiar with those different blood classification systems. We went over that. I drew some red blood cells, right? And make sure you can tell me what kind of blood type it is if I give you a... Yeah, red blood cell for ABO system and RH, both, right? Okay, well, I was able to change slides for a little bit. All right, nice. Okay, now, how is agglutination different than coagulation? Tell me something about coagulation. Yeah, it's fibrin formation, right? That produces a blood clot. So it still could be considered clumping of red blood cells, but two different processes. And coagulation is there to prevent blood loss. And so there are times when we need to decrease clotting function in people because of the circulatory patterns, maybe through their heart, blood is really slow. And whenever blood stops flowing, it has a tendency to form a clot. Right, so sometimes patients need to be on anticoagulation therapy, and it's commonly referred to as, or those agents commonly are referred to as blood thinners. Is that really a good clinical way of describing what those anticoagulants do? No, it's right, but it's okay for laymen to think of it that way, but you can't. What ion is important for coagulation?
Calcium.
Yeah, calcium, that's right. Is there, what's strange about that? A coagulation scheme. What is strange about it? There's a certain kind of feedback mechanism. Yeah, there's a positive feedback mechanism. Sorry, I can't get to the slides, right? So you just got to know where that is. It's not in your textbook, but it is in the study guide. So make sure you know where that positive feedback mechanism is. All right, so we talked about all that stuff, so let's move on unless you have a question. One thing that I do want to write on the board first has to do with flow of a fluid, which is going to be similar to how a molecule diffuses. All right, so what's the motive force for diffusion? Yeah, so concentration gradient, right? So molecules will go from high to low. All right, so this is what I'm going to draw on the board right here. High to low. That's for diffusion, but that also works for flow. Flow of any kind of fluid. It could be a gas or it could be a liquid. All right, so I'm going to put flow and high or low what? Not concentration, but there's kind of a similar concept in physics, and that is pressure. High pressure to low pressure. You see how similar it is to diffusion? Okay. All right, so in order for any fluid to flow, it's got to go from an area of high pressure to low pressure. And it doesn't go backwards. And doesn't go backwards. Okay? So we're just going to use that principle a lot. Okay, pulmonary and systemic circulations. That kind of gives you a clue as to how many sides the heart has. How many sides does the heart have? It's got two sides. It's got a right side and a left side. Right side pumps blood through the pulmonary circulation. Left side through the systemic. Should be able to trace that all around and by yourself. So a lot of these things, here's a really good diagram that shows some important things. I think the only thing that I need to make sure that you understand is, what is the definition of an artery? I see it on this slide, and it's really confusing. Okay? Because here is an artery coming from the left ventricle, and what color is that? And here's an artery from the right ventricle, and it is colored blue. Okay. Yeah, so the composition of blood or the concentration of oxygen in the blood does not determine artery or vein. It's only the direction of flow. And so if a blood vessel takes blood away from the heart, it's an artery. If it brings blood back to the heart, it's a vein. And then usually you have one kind of vascular system in between an artery and a vein. And what is it specialized to do? Capillary, and you can see exchange taking place. And that's the only place where exchange takes place. Because, anybody remember why? That's the only place?
Very thin walls.
Yeah, it's leaky and very thin walls, and the walls of arteries and veins are way too thick to allow for diffusion. All right, so things that are in the blood, in an artery, they're stuck there until they can get to a capillary, and that's why the CPR rules were rewritten not too long ago. They kind of reduced the number of respirations and increase the number of compressions, because we all know that all of this arterial blood inside somebody that's not breathing is loaded with oxygen. You just have to get it to the brain, right? And that's what those chest compressions are for. All right, so all that oxygen in these arteries is trapped. You got to get it through a capillary system somehow. Structure of the heart, you know how many ventricle or how many chambers there are in the heart. Right, how many valves are in the heart? Blood should flow through the heart only in one direction, right? So there's four valves, you got to know their names. The interesting thing on this particular slide is that between the atria and ventricles, there is some connective tissue called the fibrous skeleton. And what we're going to look at today, since it's a fibrous skeleton, it doesn't have muscle tissue going across it or nervous tissue, so it acts as an electrical insulator between the atria and the ventricles. And you all know that excitation of tissues is done by depolarization. This fibrous skeleton prevents depolarization in the atria to go into the ventricles without some kind of coordinated activity. But you should know everything else about the fibrous skeleton. Okay, circulation you got to know. All right, I want to get to the next slide. I jumped two slides, and I think really I would like to go back because I didn't see what that other slide was. All right, that's okay, I don't need to talk about anything there. Okay, so you told me that the heart has two sides, right, and it corresponds to the pulmonary and systemic circulations, and here's something that you didn't learn in anatomy, and that is the rate of flow through the systemic circulation, of blood flow through the systemic circulation, has to equal the rate of blood flow through the pulmonary circulation. All right, so the output from the right ventricle has to equal the output from the left ventricle, otherwise blood is going to back up someplace, right? In one of these parts, maybe in a pulmonary capillary, and if blood backs up and it's going to swell, get bigger and bigger and bigger, and then just explode and be a big bloody mess, right? So that can't happen. These chambers do have to create the same amount of flow. So how do you know what blood flow is? Here's a diagram. How will blood flow? From high pressure to low pressure. And then there's something else. Blood flow is going to be directly related to something, this pressure difference, right? So I'm going to put pressure on the top, but it's going to be inversely related to one other parameter, and it's got a bunch of components, but I'm going to simplify it, put one other parameter in there, and that is resistance to that blood flow. In lab, you're going to measure some of that resistance. One important factor with resistance is the diameter of the tube, or the radius of the tube. And in the next chapter, we'll look at Poiseuille's equation, which really describes that. Okay, rate of blood flow, it's got to be the same. All right, well, the pulmonary circulation is very short, right? Very, very short. It has low resistance, very low resistance. The resistance in the systemic circulation is really high because the blood goes everywhere in your body, right? But we said that blood flow has to be the same. So how is it possible that the right side of the heart maintains the same flow as the left side if the resistance changes? What has to compensate to keep blood flow the same? Okay? Yeah, if you change the resistance, then you have to change the pressure to keep blood flow the same. And since the pulmonary circulation has very low resistance, in order to keep blood flow the same, how does pressure have to change? If you decrease resistance, what do you have to do to pressure? Yeah, you decrease pressure. And that's exactly what the heart does, right? The left chamber, left ventricle, has to develop much higher pressure to pump blood through that higher resistance circuit. So what happens to a muscle when you exercise it, if you don't over-exercise it? Walk around with a 5-pound weight, right? Get that brachialis and biceps brachii working all day. Okay, in a month, what can you tell me about that biceps or brachialis? It's going to be big, right? It's going to hypertrophy. Same thing for the left side of the heart. It's going to be a lot bigger and stronger compared to the right ventricle. And I can even probably see it on this illustration. The free wall of the left ventricle is thicker compared to the right. And that's one thing you used in anatomy lab to make sure that you could identify right from left ventricle. All right, so remember, they've got to be the flow in a normal heart, normal individual is the same. So, right, the work done by the left ventricle is 5 to 7 times greater than the work done by the right ventricle because it's got to develop much higher pressure. That's an important take-home message. Okay, next slide. I don't think I missed anything. I did not. Okay. Heart valves. Well, you said that there are 4. Indeed, there are 4. Remember, there's 2 atrioventricular, 2 semilunar valves. You should know their names and what they separate. And, of course, their function. What's the function of a valve? Yeah, it keeps blood flowing in one direction. Shouldn't go backwards. If it ever starts to flow backwards and the heart has to work really, really hard, and it's eventually going to die as a result of that, right? It'd be like you running up a sand dunes. Anybody ever walk up a sand dunes? Okay. It's very difficult. Much harder than running upstairs because as soon as you take a step up, what happens? You slide back down, right? Now you got to take another one. And if you had to do that all day long, week after week, month after month, what would happen to you? You would croak. That's right. Same thing for your heart, right? That's the purpose of those valves. Here is something new, cardiac cycle. Well, the heart pumps blood, but not like an electric motor. Electric motor is spinning all the time, right? An electric pump and the fluid is flowing. But the heart is not an electric motor. It pumps blood when muscles contract. So sometimes the heart is contracting and it's pumping blood. Other times the muscles are relaxing and the heart is filling with blood. We call that a reciprocating pump. Sometimes it's pumping, sometimes it's relaxing. So those are the 2 important phases of what we call the cardiac cycle. Systole refers to the contraction phase. Diastole refers to the relaxation phase. And it just so happens that both atria contract together simultaneously, and then after that, the ventricles contract about 200 milliseconds a little bit later. All right, normal blood pressure, we said in the left or in the systemic circulation is high. Here we see 120 over 80. And these 2 numbers correspond to the systolic pressure over the diastolic pressure. Okay, so in arteries, blood pressure doesn't decrease to 0, but it does drop dramatically when the heart is in diastole, when it's not pumping. Right? And of course, this isn't strange to you. The pulmonary pressure is a lot less because the resistance of that circuit is so much smaller. It's maybe 25 over 10 millimeters of mercury. Easy to measure systemic pressure. With an auscultatory method, put a cuff around somebody's arm, listen to a brachial artery, but very difficult to measure pulmonary pressure. What would you have to do? Where would you have to go to measure pulmonary pressure? Yeah, inside somebody's chest, right? So it's not that you can't perform that when somebody's just sitting in a chair next to you. So that's difficult. So sometimes it's hard to know what pulmonary pressure is, and what condition in terms of pressure is pathological and epidemic in the United States? Yeah, high blood pressure. And the real term for high blood pressure is hypertension, right? So the systemic and diastolic pressure go way above normal. Well, there can be pulmonary hypertension. And that's really difficult because hardly anybody can measure it, but it can happen. Does anybody know what the consequences of high blood pressure or hypertension are? Well, it could be fatal in the long run, right? And that's either for systemic or pulmonary circulation. I'll probably mention that a little bit when we get into the respiratory chapter. We'll review that. All right, so do you have a sense of why the systemic circulation is so much different than the pulmonary circulation? Because the blood flow has to be the same, but the resistance is different, so the pressure changes as well. All right, so that's kind of the basics of the cardiac cycle. I remember what I wanted to say. All right, so the heart can pump blood pretty effectively. All right, and every scientist and physicians were very interested in the systolic phase of the cardiac cycle. Oh, come on, let's go back. Okay, the systolic phase. What phase is the systolic phase?
Contraction.
Right, so we used to think that if we knew everything about the contraction phase of the heart, we would know a lot about how the body maintains blood pressure, regulates blood pressure, what the function of the heart is. But then people became aware of how important the diastolic function of the heart is. What's diastolic function?
Relaxation.
Can you imagine why people are really interested in knowing how the heart relaxes and not just how it contracts? Because after contraction, what has to happen? It's got to relax so that blood can flow into the heart. If it doesn't relax properly, blood can't flow into the heart, and when the heart contracts again, it doesn't have anything to pump. Right? So diastolic function is just as important as systolic function. Okay. So here we have some volumes. Right? We have end-diastolic volume, end-systolic volume. I'm going to put stroke volume aside for just a second. End-diastolic volume is the volume of blood in one of the ventricles, and usually we talk about the left ventricle. Right? So end-diastolic is the amount of blood at the end of diastole, and end-systolic volume is the amount of blood in the ventricles at the end of systole. Which one would have a bigger number if it was a normal heart? End diastolic or end systolic? Okay, it's going to be end systolic when it's contracted, diastolic when it's relaxed. So it is the end diastolic volume that is larger. End systolic is after the heart contracts, that's going to be the smallest volume inside the ventricle. So those are important numbers. But even more important, we would like to know how much blood the heart pumps every time it beats. It can't pump out 100% of the blood inside of a ventricle, but some fraction of it, sort of like hematocrit, I suppose, right? And we call that the stroke volume, the amount of blood that the heart pumps out every time it beats. And that's measured in milliliters, right? And so are the end-diastolic and end-systolic volume. So how could we calculate stroke volume? We take the large ventricular volume and subtract the small. So you take end-diastolic volume and subtract end-diastolic volume, and that tells you how much blood is pumped every time the heart beats. All right, so make sure you can answer. Which is larger, ESV or EDV? It is? Yeah, EDV. What is the stroke volume if ESV is 20 and EDV is 80? Okay, I will just proceed to the next. Right, you just subtract those two numbers. Okay. All right, well, here is an important slide. It'll be useless to you if I read it. So, fortunately, we have a nice illustration that talks about whatever on that slide. This illustration looks a little bit complicated, but it's not too bad. All right? The one in your book is even better. The one in your lab manual, which is a part of the study guide, okay, that you have to practice labeling, is even better than this one, but this is what I got to show you. So how do you understand graphs? You look at the axes first. So here we have a bunch of lines that represent something that's happening versus time. So the horizontal axis is time, and the vertical axes, right, have different labels because we're measuring different things. This top line right here represents pressure. Right, so it's pressure versus time within the heart, different chambers in the heart. Then we have volume versus time, right, in the second row, and then we have some electrical activity on the surface of your body versus time, and then even some noise that your heart makes versus time. And they're all justified on the correct time scale so that if you know what's happening at one time area, right, or location, you can then figure out exactly what's happening with a different parameter. All right, so let's look at this top row. How does blood flow? High pressure to low pressure. That's right. And remember, blood will flow through the heart only in one direction. The valves are passive. There are no muscles that close the valves, and they only close when blood tries to flow backwards across that valve because the pressure has changed. All right, so what pressures are we looking at? Well, too bad I can't see the colors. But this looks like a bright blue color. Okay, indeed it is. It goes from 0 to 120. What's 120? That is pressure. It is the systolic pressure, right? Maximum systolic pressure. And then I can see it going to zero. That's not a pressure that you have in an artery. This is the pressure that you have in the ventricle. As a matter of fact, let's just say left ventricle. Okay. So blood pressure should only drop in a normal individual to 80 millimeters of mercury. Do you see a line that only drops to 80? Look at this one right here. Goes to 80, then what happens? Pumps up to about 120, and then what happens? Goes back down to 80, right? So this is a really good trace of what a systemic artery pressure looks like, right? It varies between 120 and 80, 120 systolic, 80 diastolic. All right, so let's look at these two curves. Aortic valve separates the aorta from the left ventricle, and it just so happens that we have both of these pressure curves. So here is the pressure in the ventricle. It is lower than the pressure in the aorta. Is blood going to flow from the left ventricle into the aorta at this location, right where I have the cursor? Because blood can only flow from high to low. And it's low in the ventricle and high in the aorta, so blood can't flow out of the heart. All right, but the heart is still contracting and pressurizes blood, and then sooner or later the pressure in the left ventricle is greater than the aorta. Now what's going to happen to blood? It's going to flow out of the heart, right? Because pressure in the ventricle is higher than pressure in the aorta. In order for that to happen, that valve at the root of the aorta has to open, right? And that's what we see right here at that intersection. The aortic semilunar valve opens, right? Just passively. Blood can flow out of the left ventricle. The left ventricle is contracting still, pumping blood, and then it's pumping a lot of blood, and then the pressure starts to decline because there's not blood left in the ventricle to press up against. So the pressure in the left ventricle starts to go down and becomes less than the pressure in the aorta. And when that happens, all right, that should actually be over here. It's shown much better in the diagram in your lab book. This is where the pressure of the ventricles and aorta cross back over each other. All right, but we'll just talk about it right here. So we have high pressure in the aorta, low in the ventricle. Which way will blood want to flow? From high to low or aorta to ventricle? In a normal heart, does that ever happen?
No.
It does not happen. Why is that? Because the aortic semilunar valve closes, right, when these pressures cross over each other, right, and so we have closing of the aortic semilunar valve, right, and then again, so this cycle just repeats itself over and over and over again. The key to understanding this is that you just have to know blood will flow from high to low. The valves are there so that blood flows only in one direction, right, and they'll open and close just passively due to blood flow. All right, so those are the semilunar valves. What's another important valve to know something about? The atrioventricular valves. And let's look at the bicuspid. Let's pretend we're looking at the left side of the heart still. All right, so we have this nice dark blue is the ventricular pressure. And then, probably doesn't have a color. Does this line here have a color?
No,
just kind of gray. Okay, that represents pressure in the atria. Right, and pressure and blood will flow from high to low. And in this phase of the heart cycle, I see that pressure in the atria is higher than the ventricle, so which way is it going to flow? Into the ventricle from the atria, right? And then the atrium contracts a little bit, right, and pumps a little bit extra blood into the ventricle, and then the ventricle is loaded with blood. It starts to contract, and you can see that it produces much more pressure than the atria, right? So blood will want to flow from the ventricle back into the atria, but it can't. Why can it not do that? Yeah, because there's a valve that closes. That's the AV valve, right? Mitral AV valve that closes when what? The pressure in the ventricle is greater than the atria and it slams closed. All right. And when does it open up? That AV valve opens up? Right here? Yeah. When the pressure in the atria is greater than the ventricles. And that's what we see right here. Here's where the AV valve opens. When valves open, typically they're not very noisy, but when they close, they slam closed and make a lot of racket, which you can hear on the surface of somebody's body. I can't hear anybody's right now, but I know you're all alive, so that's okay. Right? It makes sounds, and there are two heart sounds. One and two represent what? Representing closing of valves. This first sound represents closing of the aortic valve, right? The second sound is due to closing of the atrioventricular valves, right? So I think you should be able to see that on this diagram. All right, the middle trace looks kind of red to me, is what? Volume versus time. And this just shows you that at the end of diastole, the ventricle is at its maximal volume. It's dilated and it's filled with blood, and the atria even pump a little extra blood in there, right? And so this is right before contraction, so what kind of volume would this be right here? You only got two volumes, end systolic and diastolic volume. This is the large volume. I see it decreasing. What's the large volume once again? Okay. Diastolic, when the heart is relaxed, it fills up with a lot of blood. So this right here represents end diastolic volume. Then the heart contracts, pumps blood, blood leaves the ventricle, and then here is the minimum volume inside of a ventricle. This is the volume after contraction, right at the end of contraction. This is the end systolic volume. So if you were given this graph, would you be able to tell me what the stroke volume was? And the answer is yep, because I would just take end diastolic volume and subtract and systolic volume from it, and that would tell me how much blood left the heart when it contracted. Yeah. Okay, so it's actually pretty easy to do. Just got to remember, EDV is up over here. ESV is down over here. You subtract it to know how much blood actually left the heart. All right, one last thing. I see some electrical activity. This is what we call electrocardiogram. Sometimes it's spelled with a C, sometimes with a K. Even in the same hallway in a hospital, you see it spelled two different ways, and it means exactly the same thing, right? One is with a K, it's a little bit more archaic spelling, maybe a little bit more Germanic. C is a little bit more English, anglicized, but it means exactly the same thing. All right, so I see a change in voltage on the surface of somebody's body. I see this first wave, right? And this is what we call the primavera wave. For short, it is the P wave, right? It's the first one. This is excitation of the atria. What kind of electrical event do you know is excitatory? Yeah, depolarization, right? So P wave represents depolarization of the atria. They don't repolarize right away. There's got to be a little bit of time. And then right over here, they repolarize. And strangely enough, right, it is at the exact time that the ventricles depolarize. And what has more tissue associated with it, the ventricles or the atria? What has more mass, muscle mass? The ventricles by a lot more, right? So this, what we call the QRS wave, really represents depolarization of the ventricles. Hidden within this mess right here is repolarization of the atria, but you can never see it, right? Because the signal from the ventricles are just too big. That would be looking for atrial repolarization in the QRS would be like walking outside right now and trying to find your favorite constellation in the sky. Could you see a star in the sky right now?
No.
Because sun is too bright, right? Okay. So the QRS complex, depolarization of ventricles, excitation of ventricles. After that happens, what happens to the ventricles? They contract. Right, so this electrical activity is just the signal for contraction. It's not the measure of tension, not contraction. It is the signal for contraction, right? It's the excitation part of excitation-contraction coupling. Then, at a later time, here I see the T wave. T wave represents repolarization of both ventricles. Okay. All right, so that's kind of a short form of the electrocardiogram. This thing right here typically is called a Wiggers diagram, named after somebody who was really important in cardiology a couple of years ago, a very famous person. Okay, who can formulate a question regarding this diagram right here? Yeah, it's buried right in here, so you can't see it. There's really no way to ever measure it. Okay. Heart sounds, we talked about already. Heart murmurs. Oh, this is interesting. Heart murmurs. All right, so these are abnormal sounds that the heart makes, right? Usually you just have first and second. They can be caused by defective valves. Sometimes a valve doesn't open all the way. So let's just say you have, I should have brought a balloon. You have a balloon, blow it up with air, and if you kind of open up the mouth of a balloon just a little bit and let a little bit of air leak out, what does it sound like? A squeak. Okay? Or if you let it all escape, then yes. Okay? So sometimes the valves don't open all the way, they have a squeaky sound to them, right? Just like the mouth of that balloon. Okay, various infections can damage valves so that they're not as pliable, right? They don't open or close properly. And so that would be a defective heart valve. If a valve doesn't open all the way, we call that a stenotic valve. That's a squeaky one. But if it doesn't close all the way, that's not a stenosis. That's what we call an incompetent valve. It's going to leak if it doesn't close all the way. And then you have to decide what to do with that valve, depending on how bad the abnormality is. Maybe in the next chapter we can talk about that a little bit. We have bacteria in our mouth. This is just sort of interesting in passing. We have a number of different kinds of bacteria in our mouth. They like to live underneath dental plaque that we have surrounding our teeth. It's a nice anaerobic environment. And these bacteria will metabolize glucose and secrete acid. As a result, the enamel on your teeth dissolves in acid. So these bacteria dissolve enamel on your teeth. We call that a cavity or a dental carie. And since dental caries are caused by these bacteria, somebody thought, well, gee whiz, we can develop a vaccine. And we can prevent cavities people have from now until forever, because we can develop a vaccine against these bacteria. Okay. Unfortunately, sometimes when you develop antibodies for a particular antigen, that antigen is similar to an antigen somewhere else. And it just so happens that the antigen that is on these bacteria is very similar to antigens that are on the heart. So that when you vaccinate somebody against these bacteria, what else are you vaccinating that person against? Their own heart, right? So then they basically reject their own heart. Well, okay, you have a choice. What would you rather get rid of, dental caries or your heart? Probably dental care. Don't want to get rid of your heart, right? So this vaccine never made it to the marketplace as a result, and I'm sure people are still trying to figure out how to develop vaccines that don't destroy the person's heart at the same time. Yeah, and then, who knows? That might not be a good thing, right? Okay. All right, so heart murmurs are sounds that the heart makes when the structure of the heart is abnormal. Like stenosis, stenotic valves, mitrostenosis. What valve is the mitral valve?
Bicuspid.
What side of the heart is it on? It is on the left side. You're right. Exactly. Okay, valves that don't close, we call them incompetent. Right? And that damage can be due to a number of things. All right, on this slide, I don't see an incompetent valve or a stenotic valve, but I see some weird flow patterns. I see some blood that's in the left ventricle, and it looks like it's squirting into the right ventricle, going right through, what is that structure that separates the two? Right here? Yeah, the layer is myocardium, right here. But what part of the heart is that? That's the interventricular septum. Yeah, interventricular septum. It should not contain any passageways or foramina, right? So blood in the left ventricle should stay there. It shouldn't go over to the right. But if there is a heart defect, it can squirt from the left into the right, and it's going to make a squirting sound, squishing sound, right? So it's pretty easy to pick up with a stethoscope, and then you want to image it, and on the image, you're going to notice that blood is always going to go from the left ventricle into the right ventricle if there is a septal defect. All right, so you should be able to explain to me why blood always goes from left to right and never from right to left. Because how does blood flow? High pressure to low. And what's the pressure in the left ventricle compared to the right? It's always going to be higher, right? It's always going to be higher. So you always see evidence of that septal defect in the right ventricle. You can have a septal defect in the atrium because in the fetal circulation, there is a foramen here that bypasses blood going to the lungs, right? And what do we call that? Foramen ovale. And when you're born, that little foramen kind of, muscle doesn't really go, but a couple of flaps of endocardium come together and close that hole off so that it becomes a nice competent separation or septum between the atria. But in a lot of people, that foramen doesn't go away. And so blood can flow back and forth between these atria and will bypass the pulmonary circulation. And when you cannot rely on a placenta to oxygenate your blood, you need your lungs, then somebody's going to be in severe respiratory distress, right, and cardiovascular collapse. It's also going to kill the heart eventually. But sometimes this opening is pretty minor, and people can live until they're maybe even 40 years old before it becomes clinically significant, right? And then people will investigate why somebody's heart is failing, and they'll find something called a PFO. So what is a PFO? Well, F stands for foramen. What's the function of a foramen? It's a passageway for something. Yeah. And this O just stands for ovale, meaning that foramen that was here during development. And this P stands for patent. All right. You can have a blood vessel that is occluded or patent. If it's patent, it is open. It is conducting fluid. So a patent foramen ovale is this foramen ovale that is open so that blood can move through it. Right. So PFO is abnormal and can be surgically repaired pretty easy. Well, a number of years ago now, they've had some nice endoscopic methods to where they don't have to open up anybody's chest. They can just do this with instruments, right, threading them in through veins in a person's body. So that's, you're probably out playing softball the next day.
So you're saying
Patent. When patency is a condition when something is open and functioning. So a patent blood vessel is one that's open. Just any time.
No, I know that.
But in this particular case, it should not be right after you're born. Yeah, it should close. It shouldn't be patent anymore. Okay. And you probably noticed that in anatomy lab, there's a depression in that interatrial septum that you can look at. Mm-hmm. Okay. And if blood is squirting back and forth, that's going to create a murmur as well. Electrical activity of the heart. Well, you know the conduction system. What's the pacemaker of the heart? Here's the SA node, right? It's in what chamber of the heart? It is the right atrium. And what location of the right atrium? Near the base of the superior vena cava, anterior side of the atrium. Okay, and so cardiac muscle is autorhythmic. And it just so happens that this SA node depolarizes faster than other regions of the heart. And when it depolarizes, right, that captures the heart. The whole heart goes into contraction. Why would the whole heart be triggered into contraction if the SA node depolarizes? There's a special synapse between these muscle cells. Electrical synapse called a gap junction. Right, so if one cell depolarizes, the whole heart will eventually depolarize. That depolarization is excitatory, and that will cause muscle contraction. All right, remember we said that there is fibrous tissue between the atria and the ventricle, and there's no longer any muscle tissue, so depolarization cannot freely flow from an atrium into a ventricle, okay, except for one location. And that is right here at the atrioventricular bundle, bundle of His. There is a specialized myocardial cell that goes across the fibrous skeleton, and it takes depolarization from the atria and delivers it to the ventricle, right? And it delivers it to the bundle branches that zip that electrical signal action potential down toward the apex through the septum and then back up the free walls of the ventricles. And finally, that electrical signal is distributed throughout the heart via Purkinje fibers. Right. And this AV node right here accepts the signal that was generated at the SA node, but it conducts action potentials very slowly. So it delays the entry of that electrical signal into the ventricle. And what that does, right, it makes sure that the atria contract first before the ventricles, and that makes sense because the atria help fill the ventricles with blood. All right, so both atria contract, followed by contraction of both ventricles. So it's not necessarily that the whole heart contracts, there is a little coordination. And also, if you look at the bundle branches right here, you'll notice that the apical regions, can you see that this is an apical region right here where I have the cursor? The apical regions of the ventricles contract first, a little bit before, right, the free wall contracts, and that makes perfect sense because how is blood going to leave the heart? Up by the base or down by the apex? Yeah, up by the base. So the apical regions contract, push blood up toward the base, and that helps pump blood out of the heart. If it were the other way, then blood would be pushed down to the apex and it would have nowhere to go. All right, so that extra little coordination certainly helps flow of blood out of the heart. We've got some pretty nice diagrams. Oh, okay. I guess I want to go back. So here we have a heart, and I see two different kinds of tissues, and they're both muscle tissues. I have contractile tissue, the myocardium itself, the muscle tissue, and then I have nodal tissue. Nodal tissue is a muscle cell, but it's not specialized for contraction, but it does have voltage-gated channels in it, so it conducts electrical information just like a nerve does. But it's a muscle, but it's not really strong to contract, right? So you have contractile cells and or nodal cells, right? And they're both activated, okay, and produce action potentials. I want you to be able to recognize this thing as an action potential, but from some special place in the heart. Right? This is what an action potential in a nodal cell looks like. Right? Special muscleized cell, doesn't contract. Okay? And notice that there is no stimulus on this particular illustration. This is a plot of what? Voltage versus time. Okay? After repolarization, what happens to the membrane potential? Does it stay constant? Does it just sit here at RMP? No. What happens to it? It starts to drift up, right? It starts to depolarize slightly, and when it depolarizes enough, it reaches threshold, and then what happens? Then there's a big action potential that is produced, right? And then after repolarization, right, doesn't stay at RMP, starts to drift up again, reaches threshold, another action potential. Okay, the reason why these nodal fibers, right, have they don't have a resting membrane potential. They have what? A depolarization slope right here because they have special HCN channels, which are sodium channels that are pretty much always open. They're always leaking sodium. Which way is sodium going to go?
In.
It's going to go in from outside to in, just like you're familiar with. When that sodium enters, that depolarizes the cell, and that's going to happen continuously. When that reaches threshold, then there are voltage-gated calcium channels that open up, which causes this rapid depolarization of this nodal cell action potential, and then the potassium channels then cause, right, or result in repolarization. Right, so this is what a nodal cell action potential looks like. Looks a little bit different than an action potential that you've seen on a neuron, right? A little bit different. There's no hyperpolarization. There's no RMP, but there is a threshold. So there is one similarity.
Did you say that contractile could also produce action potential?
Absolutely. Even skeletal muscle can produce action potential. And Cardiac muscle, skeletal muscle produces action potentials because what kind of membrane protein can produce an action potential? Yeah, voltage-gated channels, like sodium and potassium voltage-gated channels. The big difference between a neuron and a muscle is a muscle contracts, a neuron doesn't. Right? And a neuron can be specialized a little bit for speed of conduction if it's myelinated. Okay? So there are some differences. Contraction is probably one of the biggest things. Okay. Okay. Here I want you to recognize another kind of action potential. All right, so if we look at all the cells in the heart, I said we can break them down into two categories, nodal cells and contractile cells. Nodal and contractile cells, they'll have different electrical activity. This is the action potential of a contractile cell. Does it look different to you right now compared to a nodal action potential? Sure does. Which one lasts for a longer period of time? Yeah, the contractile cell. All right, so, and as a matter of fact, the contractile cell has an RMP. Right? It also has a threshold, not shown very well on this particular illustration. Right? But it has the similar kinds of channels that you're used to in neurons and skeletal muscle. Right? When voltage-gated sodium channels open because of it has reached threshold because the nodal tissue has depolarized this area. Right? It reaches threshold. There is a rapid depolarization due to opening of voltage-gated sodium channels. Then normally you would see repolarization due to opening of potassium channels. But that repolarization is delayed in a contractile cell because there are also voltage-gated calcium channels that are in the cell membrane of these contractile myocytes. And so which way is calcium going to go if some calcium voltage-gated channels open? Yeah, where is calcium at a high concentration? Outside the cell, very low inside, so calcium is going to rush inside the cell. And when a cation enters the cell, does that hyperpolarize or depolarize? Yeah, it maintains depolarization, right? So this right here we call the plateau phase of this action potential. That's due to calcium channels that are opening up, and then they slowly close, and then predominantly what affects this action potential is the voltage-gated potassium channel that causes repolarization. Okay, so this is hugely important, right, that you recognize the two different kinds of action potentials, but the special action potential here for contractile cells, remember in a neuron, right, that action potentials cannot summate, right? They cannot summate, and they propagate without decrement, but more importantly, they cannot summate. Can anybody remember why they cannot summate? Typical action potentials can't summate? Okay, there's something called refractory period, absolute refractory period, where that inactivation gate is closed. Okay, let's look at this contractile cell action potential. So, it is in an absolute refractory period from the beginning of the action potential all the way over here, which is an extended period of time, right, compared to a normal action potential. And if another action potential cannot come along because of this absolute refractory period, guess what happens during this period of time? Muscle relaxation. And the heart can't be stimulated to contract again until the cell is repolarized. So this plateau phase right here prevents the heart muscle from ever going into, which we could see with skeletal muscle, if we stimulated it at a fast enough rate. Yes, cardiac muscle cannot go into tetany ever because of these calcium channels in the contractile cell's plasma membrane. So if you were going to design your heart, would you incorporate that feature?
Yeah.
Oh yeah, you'd never want your heart to go into spasm and not contract, right? If it's in a contracted form, blood can't get in because there's no diastolic function, right? And you just have a couple seconds of consciousness when that happens. Okay, so remember, contractile cells plateau phase due to these calcium channels. Yeah?
So I'm sorry, you said that when the nodal cell depolarizes, that's what causes the sodium channels open here?
Sure. Okay. Yeah, because those nodal cells share that electrical potential via gap junctions. right? It's just going to flow from one cell to another. But when it runs into a cell that has these calcium channels in it, then it's going to produce a different kind of action potential. And it just so happens that these are in the contractile cells, not so much in the nodal cells. All right, so is that pretty nifty? Do you understand the molecular basis for why a heart can't go into tetany? Okay, it's pretty easy because of those calcium channels. I think we talked about all that already. Conduction of action potentials. All right, we talked about excitation-contraction coupling and cardiac. Right, calcium comes from two sources, some from sarcoplasmic reticulum, some from an extracellular source or calcium channels that open. Right, that calcium doesn't bind to calmodulin, that's only in smooth muscle. It binds to troponin, just like in skeletal muscle. Right, then you can have cross-bridge cycling. The heart relaxes, right, when an action potential dies away, but the calcium pumps are always working, pumping calcium out of the cell or into the sarcoplasmic reticulum. And when calcium no longer is there to bind to troponin, then that cardiac cell is going to relax as a result of that. Here is just a slide that shows the action potential, right, versus contraction of a cell. And you can see that the contraction follows, right? There's a little bit of a delay from the depolarization. So depolarization is the signal for contraction, but it's not a measure of tension, or the measure of contraction is just the signal. Right? So here you can see that absolute and relative refractory period, and these action potentials can't summate. So you have one contractile event followed by relaxation. Right? You can't have a sustained contraction because of this plateau phase that produces this refractory period. All right, so how does this relate to that ECG? Okay, what did we say the QRS complex is the result of? Yeah, ventricular excitation or depolarization, which is what, the signal for contraction. All right, and that's a very rapid event. And we can measure that signal, not from one cell on the surface of your body, but all the millions of cells that make up a heart. All those electrical signals add up on the surface of your body, and that produces the QRS signal. Now, why is the T wave way over here? Because of the plateau phase of the action potential of the contractile cells in the heart. And then when repolarization takes place, what do you notice on the surface of your body? The T wave, right? So QRS is ventricular depolarization. Then you have this period of time, this refractory period. Then you have ventricular repolarization, and you can see it with this nice action potential. Right. I also see, right, that the P wave does not happen at exactly the same time as the QRS wave. Right, there's a separation in time. Why is there a separation between the P and the QRS? You should be able to relate that to some heart anatomy.
AV.
It has to do with the AV node. Yeah, because the AV node acts as a delay station which prevents the immediate entry of an action potential into the ventricles. Right, so the AV node holds that electrical signal for a little while, and then it moves into the ventricles through the fibrous skeleton, producing this QRS complex. Okay, so that's kind of a handy figure. All right, we talked about all that. Some nice diagrams that show waves of depolarization. Where does it start? SA node, gap junctions that allow that depolarization to flow through both atria, and notice that both atria depolarize before the ventricles because that fibrous skeleton is isolating atria from a ventricle electrically. Okay, you probably can see this a lot better than me because of these, here we got a color, something that tells you what's going on with colors. After depolarization, what do you get? Repolarization. So is this right here the same color as this down here? Oh, is that cool? That's nice for you guys. Okay. Then you see that depolarization moves through the AV node down to the ventricle, scoots right down the septum to the apical region. You can see the apical regions depolarizing first, right, followed by the basal regions. That's going to cause contraction of the apical regions before the basal regions, forcing blood up into the pulmonary artery and the aorta. So that's a pretty nice diagram that shows that. What do we have here? correlation. Oh, well, this is just another view of the Wiggers diagram. We looked at this already. QRS is what the signal for contraction, but is not a mechanical event, right? So you have to measure pressure or tension from a ventricle, and that comes at a later time compared to the QRS complex. Okay. One last topic, structure of blood vessels. You know a lot about blood vessels already. You know they all have layers. You might want to become familiar with the different layers because that will tell you a lot about what the function is, right? If you change the structure of these blood vessels, then that changes the function. Large arteries that are close to the heart contain a lot of elastic proteins, so that when the heart pumps and pumps a bunch of blood into an artery, the artery can expand. And then when the heart stops pumping, when it goes into diastole, what happens to that expanded aorta, for instance? Because of the elastic properties, it contracts back down, and it helps maintain blood pressure during diastole because of that. Okay, oh, here's a pretty important slide. So what do we got here? We have an artery bringing blood, and this is a systemic circulation. Here is an artery bringing blood to this network of very thin-walled blood vessels, and then blood flows into this other collecting vessel that brings it back to the heart, right? So from the heart is an artery, back to the heart is a vein. This network that is so thin that allows for exchange, this is a capillary. This is where things can enter the cardiovascular system. And there's not enough blood in your body to go everywhere. Your body has to pick where it's going to go, right? So your mother's right. Did she ever let you go swimming right after lunch? No, because she's afraid you're going to drown. Right? And the reason is because right after lunch, a lot of blood is going to your digestive tract to digest food, and you don't have that blood available to go to muscles that you're exercising in a pool. And so what happens then, the muscles don't get the correct nutrients and electrolytes, and they go into spasm, so you get a muscle cramp. And what could happen if you have a severe muscle cramp when you're swimming in a pool? Yeah, you could drown, right? You might not be able to keep your head above water. All right, so there are things that can control blood flow through capillaries, and I see one important thing here. This is what we call a pre-capillary sphincter. I'm sure you've seen these before, but what is important is how these things are controlled. The pre-capillary sphincter is not controlled by the nervous system. It's controlled by the kinds of metabolites, right, that the cells around this capillary bed are releasing. All right, so think of oxygen and CO2. If this area right here is producing a lot of CO2, what do you think should happen to this precapillary sphincter? Okay, what happens if there's a lot of lactic acid being produced and a lot of CO2? What should happen to this precapillary sphincter? It should relax and open up so that blood can flow through this capillary, pick up that CO2 and get rid of it from the tissue. Pick up that lactic acid, remove it from the tissue, and in so doing, what is it going to bring to the tissue? Oxygen, glucose, and nutrients, right? We call that local control. Local control is when these smooth muscles are controlled by chemicals in the local environment, right? And it has nothing to do with any kind of nervous reflexes. Yeah, it is smooth muscle. It's not cardiac muscle, and you can't voluntarily control it, so it's got to be smooth. Local control is when metabolites in the interstitial fluid around this capillary bed control the contraction of the precapillary sphincter. Right? When oxygen is at a high concentration and when there's plenty of nutrients in these tissues, because the tissue isn't working very rapidly, then there doesn't need to be a lot of blood going to them to bring in oxygen and nutrients. So what would this precapillary sphincter do? It's going to contract so that blood can go to other places in your body that need oxygen and nutrients. But if this is an exercising area producing a lot of lactic acid, producing CO2, maybe a lot of ADP is building up, adenosine diphosphate, then these chemicals will cause this muscle to relax. And when it relaxes, blood flow is going to be restored to this capillary bed, right? And what is it going to do? Get rid of CO2, get rid of lactic acid, bring in oxygen, and would this be a nice way of maintaining homeostasis? Local control maintains homeostasis, right? And it doesn't need a nervous system to do that. Okay, so local control, pretty important concept. You got different kinds of capillaries. I'm sure you learned about that in anatomy already. Veins. Okay, where does blood flow when it's in an artery?
Away
from the heart, that's right. It flows into a capillary, and then it flows into a vein. Why does it flow into a vein? Why doesn't it flow back to the heart? Not so much because of the chemical concentration, it's due to pressure. That's right. So what has a higher pressure, veins or arteries? Yeah, because blood is going to flow from an artery into a vein. And as a matter of fact, the pressure in a vein is very low, about 2 millimeters of mercury. What was the systolic pressure in a heart? 180, right? So there's a huge difference, a big pressure difference. So that's going to help return blood to the vein. But how does blood get from a vein to the heart? Because there's not a very large pressure gradient, right? In the heart, it's about zero, maybe minus one sometimes, but it's on the order of pressure in a vein. So how does blood get back to the heart? Okay, yes. There are two things called a skeletal muscle pump and respiratory pump. Here you see a nice illustration of a vein. A vein is a lot different than an artery because it's got these little jobbies right here. What are these things? Yeah, these are valves, and the job of a valve is to prevent the retrograde flow or backward flow of blood. So blood can only, if it's a normal vein, it can only flow toward the heart away from the periphery because of these valves. And remember, blood is going to flow from high pressure to low. So if you have this vein, and it's between two muscles that are relaxing, then the muscles are not pressurizing the blood in this vein, and it's not going to move anywhere. Right? Certainly can't move backwards. When these muscles contract, they bulge up and compress this vein. What happens when you compress a balloon? Does the pressure go up or down? Yeah, it goes up. Yeah, you compress a balloon, it goes up. So the pressure in this compartment skyrockets because these skeletal muscles are contracting. It's going to try to push blood toward the heart and away from the heart. It can't move away from the heart because of valves. The valve, right, that is leading to the heart opens up, and so blood will always move toward the heart if these veins are normal. If they're diseased and dilated, then the flaps of these valves can't touch each other. They're just going to flop back and forth, and then blood is going to just stagnate, not move, right, in this particular vein. One condition would be deep vein thrombosis. When blood stops flowing, what's one condition that follows from that? Okay, yeah, one condition would be varicose veins, which are superficial. You can see that on the surface of somebody's body. Okay, but when blood stops flowing, it has a tendency to coagulate, form blood clots. All right, and so if these valves aren't working, there can be blood clots generated that make their way to the heart, can cause heart attack, strokes, etc., etc. So vein disease is, you know, a very terrible thing to have to deal with sometimes. All right, so that's one. I don't have a picture of the other one, which is called the respiratory pump. Okay, and that's pretty easy to understand. All right, so when you inhale, what's happening to the size of your thorax? Does anybody remember from, think of a bellows that you use to blow air on a fire. Okay, how does air go into the bellows? You increase the volume. How does air flow out? Decrease the volume, right? Increase, air goes in, decrease. Same thing for your chest, right? In order for air to enter your lungs, you have to increase the volume of your thoracic cavity by contracting some muscles. Maybe the diaphragm increases the volume. That decreases the pressure in your thoracic cavity. High pressure in the air, low pressure in your lungs. Which way is air going to go when the volume increases? From high to low, it goes in. To exhale, what has to happen? The volume of your thoracic cavity decreases, pressurizing the air above atmospheric pressure, and then air is going to flow out. All right? And that's just a cycle going back and forth. Well, not only does air flow in and out of your thoracic cavity, but any kind of fluid that's attached to your thoracic cavity will flow when the pressure decreases. right? So your thoracic cavity just becomes a vacuum cleaner. When you expand the thoracic cavity, air starts to flow in. Guess what else is sucked into the thoracic cavity? Yeah, fluid, like blood. Okay, so every time you inhale, blood is sucked up into the thoracic cavity. And what organ is in your thoracic cavity ready to pump that blood again? Yeah, your heart, right? So every time you breathe, that helps venous return. It helps return blood to the heart because your thorax is acting like a vacuum cleaner when it increases the volume. All right, so that's the respiratory pump. All right, so you got these two things, skeletal muscle pump and respiratory pump. And these things are necessary because the pressure in a vein is very, very low, maybe two. The pressure in the heart is about that same order. And in order for blood to flow, what has to be true? There's got to be a pressure difference. No pressure difference between a vein and a heart, blood won't flow unless you have these auxiliary pumps working in your favor. But of course, that all depends on whether these valves are healthy or not, right? This vein cannot dilate. Okay, so that's it for this particular chapter. I think my recorder was working just fine. So I will post it. Let's see, what do I have to do? I will post it tonight. I will, absolutely. Probably not this afternoon, but early evening, I'll post it. Sure.
As you breathe in, your thoracic cavity
expands,
which allows...
That decreases the pressure inside the thoracic cavity. There's an inverse... We'll look at this when we get to the rest. There's an inverse relationship to volume and pressure. Volume increases, pressure decreases, because there's that inverse relationship. Volume decreases, pressure increases. Just think of that balloon. Take that balloon, squeeze it down, decrease the volume. What happens to pressure? It increases. Can it increase so much it might pop? Right. So same thing for your chest. If you increase or if you decrease the volume, that pressurizes the fluids in your thoracic cavity, air is going to flow out. And if you expand your thoracic cavity, that decreases the pressure, pressure is going to flow in. All right. So our air is going to flow in. But the same thing for blood. If air is flowing into your lungs, blood is flowing from the periphery into your thoracic cavity because it's a vacuum cleaner. Yeah, it's exactly right. By pressure difference. Right. Expand the thoracic cavity, blood flows in to the thorax. Decrease the volume of the thoracic cavity, that won't allow blood to return to the heart quite as easily because there's no longer that pressure gradient. Okay, what other kinds of questions do you have? Oh, we've still got 10 minutes left. Okay. What kind of questions? Is there anything else I want to go over? The only thing I want to make sure is make sure you get this local control concept. I think your book doesn't do a very good job of local control. So let me ask you, what kind of chemical compounds are going to cause relaxation of the smooth muscle, causing dilation of this blood vessel?
CO2,
a metabolic byproduct. Right? That shouldn't be in those tissues. CO2, what else is a metabolic byproduct that's due to maybe anaerobic metabolism? Lactic acid, that's right. And if there's not oxygen, these cells cannot make ATP from ADP, so concentration of ADP is going to increase as well. ADP can cause these muscles to relax, and blood flow is going to go through this capillary. Right? What about oxygen and glucose? It's going to cause contraction because these tissues are fine, just the way they are. They have enough oxygen, they don't need blood, and so that blood should go to other areas of your body that needs it. We call that local control. And that's due to these precapillary sphincters. Okay, and I think the only other thing I want to say is that the sign-in sheet is going around. And you want to answer these questions really quick before we go? Okay. Structure of blood vessels. Please know and review this anatomy on your own. Okay. Well, we'll make it a fun exercise. Material can enter or leave the blood only through a capillary. What structure regulates blood flow through a capillary? What structure regulates blood flow? That was the pre-capillary sphincter. Pre-capillary sphincter, smooth muscle. Right? A sphincter is a circular smooth muscle. Name two mechanisms which help return blood to the heart. Muscle pump and respiratory pump. Name three types of cardiovascular structures that have valves. Oh, I didn't go over this. Your heart has valves. Your vein has valves. And I didn't mention one other thing. I haven't talked about it at all except for the very first slide. There are vessels in your body that are very much like veins. They're very low pressure. They don't contain any formed elements, but they contain like extracellular fluid that looks a lot like plasma, and that is lymph. That's right. So lymphatic vessels also have veins. Right, so their physiology is kind of similar. Okay, so you got heart, you got veins, and lymphatic vessels. Lymph vessels all have valves. Does an artery have a valve?
No.
No. As long as you say aortic valve belongs to the heart and not the aorta. Okay. So arteries don't. Why does an artery not have a valve? Because there's always such high pressure in it, blood is always going to leave. Right? It's always going to leave. Name three types of cardiac that have valves. Which layer is responsible for forming valves? I talk about this in anatomy, but I sure didn't today. What are the three layers that make the myocardium? Three layers. You got endocardium, myocardium, and an epi. So I got endocardium, myocardium, and epicardium. Or you could go the other way around. You could say epicardium, then myo, and then endo, right? Lining the internal cavities of the heart. The layer that's responsible for valves, remember we said it's passive, it's not active, it's not the myocardium, it's not the muscle layer, it is endocardium. All right, so endocardium is responsible for forming valves, and that's really nice because you've probably looked at the inside surface of a heart, and when you looked at it and maybe felt it with your finger, is it flat and shiny and slippery, or is it all jagged and ragged? Okay. Okay, it looks a little rough because of all the muscles, papillary, carne asada muscles, not carne asada, I think it's lunchtime, but if you were to look at the endocardium, you would see that it's very smooth and slippery. Why smooth and slippery? So that blood can flow over the internal surfaces of the heart without causing blood clots. Same thing for valves. They have to be smooth and slippery so they don't generate clots. And so it has to come from endocardium. And so if there's a diseased valve, maybe it has a plaque of calcium or lipid layer, it can be rough, it can generate blood clots. Right? But not if it's a nice, healthy valve. What's the difference between a sphincter and a valve? This is sort of interesting. What kind of tissue made that precapillary sphincter?
Smooth muscle.
What makes a valve? Not smooth muscle, but connective tissue, right? So a sphincter is an active device that can control the patency of a foramen, but a valve is completely passive. It just opens and closes depending on pressure across the valve, and blood is going to want to try to flow through. When it tries to flow backward, then the valve is just forced closed. Okay, so sphincter is muscle, valve, connective tissue. Connective tissue doesn't contract. What would be one way you could tell me that connective tissue doesn't contract? What does connective tissue not have? What kind of membrane protein?
Voltage-gated.
Yeah, it doesn't have voltage-gated channels. Exactly right. So it can't be. So connective tissue is not excitatory. Can't be excited because it doesn't have those voltage-gated channels or ligand-gated channels. All right, so those are those questions. Hopefully, once we talked about them, it was pretty easy. Okay, sign-in sheet is going around. A picture ID, pencil, and eraser next time, please. I don't think you need a calculator.